Good evening. We have a very long parasha today. Mimatos Masei, finishing off Sefer Shemos. After a very difficult time for Bnei Yisrael, we've gone through 38 years in the Midbar here, or almost all of 38 years, and Aaron and Miriam have now perished. Only Moshe is left, and he has, of course, Yeshua to help him out. But now, since God has told him it's time for him to leave, he has many mitzvahs to give over to a new generation that he realizes. Now, it's probably discussed on some level last year. But what we have over here is the first thing that is mentioned and has not been mentioned heretofore is the inyan nedarim, making promises, swearing, and getting some wiggle room to weasel out of making a promise. And the Avraham likes the point of saying we don't want to give the idea. Moshe waited till the very end before he had to go for certain mitzvahs on purpose. Obviously, we certainly have to think that while they were at Har Sinai, the months they spent over there, that they went through all the mitzvahs. But of course, this is a new generation who at some point in time probably never heard it directly from Moshe. Maybe they heard it from the Zekanim, who Moshe taught it to the Zekanim, the Sari Alofim, the Sari Ameot, as we see next week, that we're in Parshas Devarim, how it's laid out, how the courts were set up. But nevertheless, Moshe wants them to understand that if they make promises, and of course, one of the reasons he's making them aware of it right now is that they're going to war. And people make a lot of promises before they go to war, hoping that God will let them return safe and sound, even though at this point in time, not many were going to go to war. It's Elef Lamateh. God told them just to send to enhance the size of the miracle for everybody to see, not only the Goyim to see this, not only the Amon and Moab and the Midian to see this, but for the Jews themselves to understand that how many people are fighting for them is immaterial. It can only be a few, it could be one, whatever it is. All the power is in God's hands, which we explained in the last couple of weeks, what God was interested in gaining. So we make promises, but the reality is if somebody makes a promise, in other words, a man's wife, there should be one voice emanating from a household, so that if a wife makes a promise and a husband is unhappy with the promise, he could nullify the promise. The interesting thing is, or a child in the house makes a promise. Of course, the only way that doesn't work is if a man himself makes a promise, and then he has no wiggle room, really, unless he goes to Beis Din and explains that had he known some interesting things. Of course, the most obvious thing that we see today is, for instance, if somebody has an affair during the second minig after Lag BaOmer, and his minig is to have the second, keep the second minig from Rosh Chodesh until Shavuos, he has to be Matanei there and go before three rabbis, and they will ask him if he had known that this wedding would take place at this juncture, would he have kept this promise? And obviously not. He would have changed his minig for the first day, or vice versa. But nevertheless, these are ways that it can be handled. This is a very difficult thing, and Moshe didn't want the people to out of hand realize that this is easily gotten out of. You make a promise, as the Torah tells us a few times in the Chumash. Make sure whatever you say something, make sure you keep it. You don't even have to say your promise. Anything that comes out of your mouth, your word is your bond. That's really what it's all about. But now we have people going to war, and they wanted to maybe say some things that they can't keep the promise. And that's what it's all about. We move on to the next thing over here, but the idea is, why does it say after somebody, the husband has forgiven his wife's vow, abrogated the vow from the wife or from one of his children, and it says, Hashem Yislach Lo, God will forgive her. If she was a vow was annulled, why would she need forgiveness? For the simple reason that she was really obligated to keep it. Unbeknownst to her, could be that she already violated it, and she did not know that her father abrogated the promise, and therefore she needs forgiveness because in her mind she violated the promise. It's a lesson for us all. Now, of course, there are so many things in the parasha here. One of the interesting things over here is the when we get to Parashas Maaseh, we get to the 42 Maasos. What is the whole idea of the Maasos? Why it lists all 42 now? Didn't we go through all of it up to now? When we said when Bnei Yisrael, Dayibush Allah Farawasa'am, it listed there all the trips that they made, all the stops that they made. The reality is it did not list so many of these stops. It only listed the very few in reality, but here it's listing every single stop that they made. But the point of listing these 42 stops is it makes it seem we get the opinion that they were bone weary from traveling so much. Every minute it seems that they had to get up. According to the Chumash, if we're following the story without realizing the years, as we see in next week's parsha when it says, "Bayomim Sher Halakim Mikodesh Barnea," they were in Kodesh for 19 years in one place. They had the ability to be there. And not only did they live there for 19 years, they set up camp and lived in one place for so long. In many of the stops, they lived for a very long time. And what they got from that is what God wanted to happen, which was so difficult for them to understand. They were in a desert, let alone having a few people survive in a desert, but having 3 million people survive in a desert where there's no food forthcoming, certainly no water forthcoming. All the creature comforts are not there. And yet they were able to survive these 40 years, and God wanted them to appreciate they had man from heaven and water from a rock and all of these creature comforts. And of course, even when they complained about not having meat to eat, they had slug, they had various things that they were able to accomplish and have. Even in what was in those days, what would be normal, this was beyond the realm of reality that God made them much more comfortable than certainly a trip in the desert, as we would see. And that was the reason that they list all these 42. The interesting thing is, as well, is that some of the places that we read in the Chumash up to now, at this point in time, they're given different names. And the reason they're given different names, because God, if you take a look at the 42 places, it doesn't mention all the negativity that happened in those places. It doesn't mention the Maisa Meraglim until later. It doesn't mention the Egel. It doesn't mention various missteps that they made. It just says these places. But of course, as we know, most of the time, you don't have to spell out what happened in a place. If you give a place a nickname, that tells you, that reminds you right away when you said, remember this particular place, and you say like a code word for something that went on there, it reminds you of all the places or that particular place, what happened there. And it's a reminder that that's why for 40 years you've been languishing here at this point in time, which is a tremendous point. Now, what we get in the interesting thing when they come back from the war, and they come back with so many spoils of war, and the Reuven and Gad have so many animals, and even though it was split up, not everybody wanted, not everybody was planning to be, even though it was certainly going to be an agrarian society, but not everybody was necessarily a farmer. But some of them would be like Zebulun, they would be in the shipping business, they had various occupations that people would be, but Reuven and Gad amassed a tremendous amount of animals, and they were looking for grazing area for all their animals, and they come to Moshe, and they ask him if they could stay Aver Yarden. They don't know how to approach him, but here it is. Imagine that Moshe is finally bringing them to on the precipice of the promised land, and two Shvatim come along and say, we have decided with your permission we would like to stay Eiver HaYarden. Moshe, wanting so badly to go in, he says to them, I planted the seeds for you. I took you out of Mitzrayim and I stayed with you for 40 years, groomed you, got you ready to cross the land to go in with you. And yet I don't get the only thing that I wanted in my entire life for everything that I did. The only reward I was hoping to get was to go into the promised land. And you, who are now have the ability to go in, you're turning it down. This is a terrible sin, and God will not look kindly. I want you to be aware of your sin. But God tells them at this point in time, God tells Moshe to tell them, well, if they want to do it, it's, so to speak, their funeral. And what do I mean by their funeral? Because the reality is, even though Churban didn't happen, the destruction of the temple and going into God, the Golus actually began in the year 33-38 when the temple was destroyed. The first Shvatim, all the Shvatim went in at different times. The 10 tribes, the northern kingdom of Israel, was taken into slavery, taken into Golus much earlier. And of course, as one might expect, the first ones that were being picked off were Reuven, Gad, and Hatzishevet Menashe, way earlier than the rest of the Shvatim. That is their punishment. The Uchat Hashem is that they would go into Golus. And why in particular? Because they put finances before the ability to live in Eretz Israel. They had the ability to live comfortably in the land of Israel with everything promised and laid out before them, that everything would be fine, nothing to worry about. They didn't have to worry about making a living. They were being given land and homes and everything set up for them, and they decided to stay. And to prove the point that money was the catalyst in everything, when they tell Moshe says, you're going to have to come back and fight for the land, and that's on one condition, God says, to make sure of to instill unity, to be still a unified nation, is that if 9.5 Shvatim go into the land and you stay behind and living over here, they helped you conquer the land that you will keep. You have to promise that you will keep the land that to conquer the land that that they need yet. So they make that promise, but in that promise they make a very critical error in what they promised Moshe. They say that we will build shelter for our animals and homes for our children. And Moshe hears these words and says to them, God is going to let you stay Eiver HaYarden, but make one thing clear. I see that money is first and foremost on your mind, which is not a good sign, because what you should have said was homes for your children and then pens for your animals. You put the animals before the children, that says an awful lot. And we see that a lot of times, that people take this is the basis for the Chet HaRishon, that Cain killed Hevel. I shouldn't say Chet HaRishon, but the reason, according to Mepharshim, that Cain killed Hevel, because while Cain brought crops for his carbon to Hashem, Hevel slaughtered an animal to bring it, a beautiful animal that he killed, and he thought that killing is killing, and he equated killing an animal with killing a human being, according to Chazal, and that was his undoing. Well, if Hevel could kill and God was pleased, then I could do the same thing. Of course, that is just a mistake that we made, that some people put animals or various things, and not realizing that God created the world and everything in it for the sole purpose for human beings to use it for their benefit, not the other way around. The animals are not here. We're not here to serve the animals. The animals and everything that is in this earth, is on this earth, was for the benefit of human beings. And that is what the be-all and end-all of everything is. And while they make this promise, Moshe is aware of one thing. If you take a look at the Lashon, the language used, and it says, Vayikshu Elo Vayomru Gidros Son Nivneh Lemekneinu Vyarim Letapenu, they came close to him. In other words, just like Vayigash Elo Yehudah and Bereshit, they got very close as if to whisper to Moshe their intentions and what they had planned. But Moshe was afraid that maybe they're whispering because what if nobody else but Moshe hears about it, and Moshe is going to die, the secret will die with him, and if they don't come through with their promise, no one else will know. And therefore, Moshe calls forth Yehoshua and Elazar HaKohen and the Zekanim, and he tells them the whole story, that this is what they promised, to make sure that everybody knows about it and that they understand that everybody knows about it. And that would be a terrible thing if they backed out. Now, one of the things that we have in this parasha, which is very interesting as well, is that the Ari Miklot, the establishment of Ari Miklot, and the ratio would seem very unbalanced. Moshe tells them which cities, as we see in next week's reading, which cities will be Aver HaYarden and which cities will be in the land of Israel and which will be Transjordan. And it would seem since nine Shvatim are in the nine and a half tribes will be in the land of Israel, there should be more, there should be a greater level of perhaps four cities in Eretz Israel and only two. If there are only two and a half Shvatim, maybe only two should be Aver HaYarden and Transjordan. But Moshe realizes fully well that the problem of living in Chutz La'aretz, living in the land, especially if the people are living there for the sake of money, if that's what is first and foremost in their mind, then that will create many arguments and much divisiveness. And therefore, we need to have, even though there's two and a half tribes, we're going to have to set up three in Transjordan, even for just two and a half Shvatim. We're going to need cities of refuge at a greater ratio than in the land of Israel, where people are there more apt to be closely related and following the precepts of the Torah and living a more, so to speak, gentlemanly life and not be required to have too many Ari Miklot, which is something we have to keep in mind. Once again, Moshe understands that the proclivity of building your life around finance, of course, we know you need money to live, but the reality is that it depends on what you're focusing on, how you need all those things. And let's see what we have here next. Yes, and one of the things that we see also is interesting. When we get to the 42 Masos, we notice one thing that is quite interesting that we didn't see at the first place. When the Bnei Yisrael crossed the Yam Suf, they went ahead and they crossed the Yam Suf. And it says, Vayisumi Yam Suf, Vayavoz Derech Shloshis Yamin Bamidbar V'lo Masu Mayim. And it makes it sound like they left the Yam Suf and they went 3 days and they didn't find water. And they complained to water and that was it. But we notice over here, if two psukim, a couple of psukim apart, it says, when it says initially they crossed the Yam Suf, and then suddenly it says it again, that they left the Yam Suf, it mentions it a second time, which tells us that they went back. And that's when they went back, initially when they first traveled from the Yam Suf, all they left behind was Sus Varok Bo Roma Vayom. They saw the Egyptians drowning. So how did they get the money and all the things, the spoils? They didn't dive into the sea to pick them out. But of course, the sea spit out all the jewels. And certain things, of course, were on the seashore. But nevertheless, they came back a second time. And when they came back the second time, everything had been spit out. And they, Vayar Yisrael Eseyad Ogdolo, they saw all the dead Egyptians lying on the seashore. They didn't, in other words, when somebody drowns, he sinks to the bottom and stays there. But they didn't just float to the surface. they came out on land, all these dead bodies were lying there with all their spoils of war, with all their gold and jewelry that they were able to pick up from the land. And that's a very interesting part of the story, that when we see the 42 Nisyonos, it says that we have, in other words, we take a look, when it says Vayisumi Pi, Vayisumi Sukos, and so on and so forth, Vayisumi Pnei Achiros, Vayavru B'tzoch Hayom HaMedbora, Vayelchu Derech Shlosh Yisumim B'Medbar Eitzon. They went 3 days after they left the Yamsuf, they went 3 days in the Midbar Eitzon, and they went to Moro, Vayisumi Moro, Vayoel Lima. And it says, Uveilim Shtei Mesre Einos Mayim V'Shivim Tamarim, and they stayed there. And then it says, Vayisume Elim, and the Pasuk ends, Vayisheni, Vayachanu Al Yam Suf. What does that mean? They went back to the Yam Suf. And then it says again, Vayisume Yam Suf, Vayachanu B'Midbar Sin. They went back to get all the spoils of war, and Moshe had to drag them away from getting it. Of course, what's very important that we learn is Hagolas Kalim. When they went to war and they brought back all these pots and various things that they, utensils that they used, that they took from them, which were valuable in those days. You didn't have a place where you go shopping for dishes and silverware. And they took all these pots back, and Moshe had to tell them now how, if you want to use them, this is, you have to go through Hagolas Kalim, Tibolo Kachpolto, the way you use it. And this is how we live today. The question that is debated among Chazal, this is not the first war and not the first time they brought home spoils of war. What happened in the previous Sedra, the end of Hukas, and in Pinchas, when they went to war with Midian, when they went to war with the Sichon and the previously in other parishes, and they brought home spoils of war, how come they weren't around to tell them they weren't told us before? We're not giving good answers about it, but nevertheless, they weren't told, and supposedly because it wasn't that many, according to some, try to answer it very simply, because those were not major battles, and what they brought home was minimal and easily dealt with. But this time, what they brought home, the spoils of war, was so massive, it had to be dealt with in an orderly fashion, so that they could use it. It wasn't necessarily, these were not the things they were looking for previously. And that was the thing. But of course, the parasha ends, and we say once again, as I always tell you, Chazak, Chazak, Venis, Chazay, they have finally come, they have been through so much, and so many evil stories, so many missteps that happened from Bahaloscha to Chuk, to the Meraglim in Shalach, to Maisa Korach. They thought they were about to go into the land, and they took all these missteps and ended up going into the, finally getting to the precipice where Moshe and Aaron, and at this point at least Aaron and Miriam, they lost the two of the three leaders that were guiding them, and it was a downer. But Chazak, Chazak, Venis, Chazek, you have finally reached the promised land, and you only have a few months to go until you march into the promised land. We keep that in mind when we bench Rosh Chodesh, and may we keep that in mind. We'll discuss more about the 9 days next week. Thank you, and have a good week. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Yeshikoah.